Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. American arms once again deployed in the Middle East, now over Libya. But this time, everything is supposed to be different. The People Power movement turned armed uprising, begged us to come to their aid. The Arab League signed off, and the UN. British and French pilots are out there flying alongside Americans. The people of Libya are supposed to write the last chapter of this story. But the fact is, the end game, the outcome, the lasting impact are all up in the air. This hour On Point, the intervention in Libya and where it goes. You can join the conversation. Is the UN, are we, on the right track with this weekend's big show of force? What's the best outcome here? What's the worst? What's the likely? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We will speak with Libyans this hour, including one resident of Tripoli who's been taking part in the uprising. But first, for an update from Libya, we turn to reporter James Foley, correspondent for Global Post. He's in Benghazi, the rebel stronghold in eastern Libya, which until this weekend looked to be the site, perhaps, of the uprising's last stand. Jim Foley, thank you very much for being with us. What's the situation there right now?
Hi, Tom. I'm in Benghazi, as you mentioned, and the situation is pretty chaotic. There's been sporadic gunfire throughout the night, but the front has clearly been moved out by Allied strikes.
Meaning Gaddafi's forces have been pushed out of the city? Who's fighting there then?
Yes, what happened was we went to see some bomb sites where French jets struck Gaddafi's column. There were about 8 destroyed tanks and vehicles. And last night, it seems like there's elements of Gaddafi's forces still in the city. They've been here for years. They're Gaddafi loyalists, and they're setting up sort of a guerrilla-type fight right now with the rebels.
So would you say that the rebels are in control of Benghazi now or not, Jim?
Yes, they're definitely in control of Benghazi, but it's a very chaotic situation. There's reports from hospitals of shootings of civilians and random attacks. People are very afraid still, and they're suspicious of many, many people who might have worked with Gaddafi's regime.
Remind us of the situation just before this UN-sanctioned intervention, no-fly zone, bombs and so on from the air. Before that began, just a couple days ago now, what was the situation the rebels found themselves in?
Oh, it was preparing for a full battle, a city battle. There was a tank spotted on the bridge about 3 kilometers outside the city. We went down to the front lines, and heavy rocket attacks from Gaddafi's forces, repelled by the rebels, but also casualties from rocket attacks, civilian casualties when the rockets hit houses. It was preparing for a bloodbath.
And what about now, Jim? You're there in Benghazi. What are rebel leaders, if there are such things available to you, what are they saying about their prospects now that we've seen such a very large show of force right across the country by these American, British, French fighters?
We talked to the secretary of the Revolutionary Committee today, and of course they're very, very happy that the attacks, the airstrikes happened. They do not want ground forces, foreign ground forces, that's for sure. But they are happy with the airstrikes. They say there have been no civilian casualties from the airstrikes. And they say they are pushing towards embattled cities like Ajdabiya, which is 160 kilometers south. But there is still heavy fighting between Gaddafi forces and the rebels in the west, places like Misrata, which have been almost leveled.
Do you have a sense, Jim, from there in Benghazi, of whether or not the Libyan rebels have the capacity to carry through on their effort to push Gaddafi out, even with this support from the sky? We've heard NPR reporters talking about rebels, you know, sort of knots of teenagers with old shotguns and hunting rifles. Do the rebels have the capacity to follow through after this air barrage that we've seen this weekend?
I'd say that's a huge question. There are senior generals
James Foley breaking up on us there from Benghazi in Libya, but I think we got the key point he's making about rebel capacity. Huge questions over whether they have the capacity to swing in behind this big UN Security Council sanctioned airstrike campaign that we have seen unfold over this weekend. Here's the sound of Hillary Clinton talking about the whole picture there on Saturday, speaking at a meeting of coalition partners in Paris, new coalition here now, over Libya, said that left unchecked, Muammar Gaddafi would continue to inflict violence on his people.
There has been some talk from Tripoli of a ceasefire. But the reality on the ground tells a very different story. Colonel Gaddafi continues to defy the world. His attacks on civilians go on.
We'll see how long they can go on now under this air assault, but then what comes after or in the midst of this assault? Yesterday, Gaddafi spoke on Libyan TV from an undisclosed location, saying that he's ready for war and that his regime will come out victorious no matter how long it may last.
We will hold to our land, to our rights. We will fight inch by inch. This land has been stained with the blood of our people, our leaders, our forefathers. We promise you a long drawn war and patience that has no limit.
We're looking at this hour at the intervention in Libya and where it goes. NPR's Tom Jelton will join us in a moment, but let's hear some Libyan voices first. First, joining me from New York, Nejla Abdulrahman, Libyan-American, dissident, doctoral student at Columbia University, part of a group called Enough Gaddafi, a loosely organized group of children of Libyan exiles trying to spread the word about what's been going on in Libya. We talked with her when the uprising there was at its early height, before Gaddafi pushed back so hard. Nejla, thank you very much for being with us again.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
And with us from, and we've agreed to this, an undisclosed location in Europe is Ali Jabri, an American-educated Libyan businessman, lives in Tripoli, but spent the last week outside the country receiving medical treatment for gunshot wounds to his legs that he got while taking part in demonstrations in Tripoli. He plans to be back there later this week. We'll see about that. Now, Ali Jabri, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom.
So, what do you see? What do you see with this intervention? A UN Security Council sanctioned, lots of jets and bombing over Libya now. We've seen the images of things being taken out and smoking and destroyed. Does this give new life to the uprising, to the rebellion?
Yes, for sure. I think this will help a lot. Okay, this is something that we demanded. Okay, we started the demonstrations very peacefully on the 17th, in Benghazi actually on the 15th, and Tripoli I talk about is on the 17th of February. On the 20th, they started attacking us. Okay, with machine guns and anti-aircraft machine guns, and we couldn't go out anymore. So that's why, okay, we asked for this, and we asked the United Nations to help us. And I think, okay, what's going on now is something we asked for, and it's going to help bring a democracy for Libya.
We've seen a big, big display of air power over the weekend. Ali Jabri, do you believe the rebels on the ground have the capacity, the resources, the numbers to follow through or come in behind this air barrage and succeed?
Oh, yes, they will. They will. I have a first-hand experience in Tripoli. On the 20th of February, the demonstrations went out, and they outforced the security in Tripoli, and they actually overtook the Green Square.
Mm-hmm.
So I can see that, okay, once they see a big movement coming up, I mean, okay, Gaddafi's forces, when they see a big movement coming up, they will just hide. And you will see that in the next few days. You will see the uprising coming up better in Tripoli, and which is, if Tripoli goes into the uprising, Gaddafi regime will go away.
Nejla Abdulrahman, in New York, the last time we spoke, hopes were very high of an imminent Gaddafi collapse or exit from Libya. That did not happen. Mm-hmm. Where do you see the situation now? These big powers have come in very strong with air support. Can this pave the way for Libyans to do now what they could not do in the last month, Nejla?
Yes. Last time we spoke, I don't think we could have anticipated what's happening now, and it's really heartbreaking, and it's sad for people. I think that the trajectory in Libya has shifted so much, and that it's moved away from what we saw in Egypt and what we saw in Tunisia, unfortunately.
Kind of jasmine revolution, people power, right. Peacefully in the streets, yeah.
Right, and that Gaddafi really forced these people to take up arms and defend themselves. I think that I agree with Mr. Jabri. I think that this was necessary. The Libyan people were asking for it. And I think Libyans, both inside and outside of Libya, pro-democracy Libyans absolutely support the UN Security Council resolution and the no-fly zone. There are people, obviously, who are very pleased about it. I'm sort of not uneasy, but it's sort of I sort of view it as an undesirable last resort in really a situation that doesn't offer very many good options.
Do you think Libyans can now win their uprising without foreign troops on the ground in Libya?
You know, I do think that they can. I think that if the coalition forces are successful in neutralizing Gaddafi's forces to a certain extent, that yes, the people will be able to come out onto the streets and hopefully finish what they started.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the intervention in Libya. We've been talking with Nejla Abdurrahman, a Libyan-American dissident, joining us today from New York, and from Europe, Ali Jabri, an American-educated Libyan businessman who has been in and out of the country during this time of uprising and has been in Europe lately getting medical treatment for gunshot wounds he got demonstrating in Libya. Tom Jelton of NPR joins us in just a moment. Here's President Obama in a press conference last Friday saying that the Libyan leader had lost the confidence and respect of his people, and that justified an international military response.
In this effort, the United States is prepared to act as part of an international coalition. American leadership is essential, but that does not mean acting alone. It means shaping the conditions for the international community to act together.
So far, that's just what Washington and others appear to have done. En route today to St. Petersburg, Russia, Defense Secretary Robert Gates stressed to reporters that the U.S., the Pentagon, does not intend to take the lead role on what they're calling Operation Odyssey Dawn.
We expected in a matter of days to be able to turn over the primary responsibility to others. We will continue to support the coalition. We will be a member of the coalition. We will have a military role in the coalition, but we will not have the preeminent role.
We will not have the preeminent role. Tom Jelton, correspondent for NPR, joins us now from Washington, watching all these things very closely there. Tom, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
So do we have any better sense of how the burden shifting is supposed to go here? How soon the U.S. shifts primary role to Britain, France, I don't know, Qatar? Is it clear, Tom?
Hey, I got a list here, Tom. The United States, Great Britain, France, Italy, Canada, Spain, Belgium, Denmark, and Qatar. So quite
Are they all in there already, Tom?
They are all... It's not clear. They're certainly not all there physically, you know, with their own assets. They have all signed up. They are, as a minimum, moving their assets into position. And some of them, of course, are there already. Great Britain, France are there already. Canada, I think, has been taking part at sea in the Mediterranean Sea. At this point, this is a U.S.-led, U.S.-commanded operation. And as I'm sure you know, Tom, one of the principles of U.S. warfighting is that U.S. troops, whenever they're deployed, U.S. forces, whenever they're deployed, are almost always under a U.S. command. And with U.S. forces in the lead now, at least air assets, this is officially led by the United States. The operational commander is an admiral who is working off a command and control ship in the Mediterranean, the Mount Whitney. And the overall commander is General Carter Ham, who's the commander of U.S. Africa. America Command. So at the top, it's totally U.S. But the United States, as Secretary Gates said, is anxious to see this transition to an international coalition. That will entail a new command and control arrangement, at which point I think you'll see some of the U.S. assets pull back and let other countries take charge. As to when it'll happen, he said days, not weeks. I think, you know, it'll be a few days, though.
Tom, there was so much emotional response and support has been for the Arab wave that we saw come up in Tunisia and go to Egypt, and all the uprising we saw out of Tahrir Square, lots of excitement about that. Also excitement for Libyans when they began to step up. So I'm sure many Americans have been extremely sympathetic to the move. I mean, it's not as though Muammar Gaddafi is anybody's idea of the perfect leader. On the other hand, Americans have a lot of experience with military engagements in this part of the world not going terribly well. Have you had described to you, Tom, by officials in Washington, the scenario that they hope plays out here? What does it look like?
I think the closest that we came to that was on Saturday. You played a clip from Secretary of State Clinton in Paris, and she was asked a very similar question. And basically she said that as a result of this operation, conditions will be created in Libya where people around Gaddafi will rethink their loyalty to him. That is, to me, as clear a vision of the hoped-for scenario as we're likely to get. Admiral Mike Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, repeatedly said yesterday that there is not here a military objective to remove Gaddafi from power, but I think implicitly here is the idea that the situation on the ground will change as a result of this, and you will be able to peel away support from the inner circle around Gaddafi, and that his regime will then topple. It's a it's a hope, it's a wish. It's there's an old expression in the military: hope is not a method. But I think that's what we got here.
Of course, there doesn't seem to be necessarily even agreement over targeting Gaddafi or not. Yes, the U.S. military said exactly as you described there, but missiles landed pretty close to his residential compound, even in it. And British Foreign Secretary and others in the U.K. Sort of a chain of command, not saying that they're not going to go after Gaddafi. Ali Jaberi, in Europe, help us understand the people around Muammar Gaddafi. If Hillary Clinton is hoping, counting on people in his inner circle to peel away and leave him alone so that he would flee or fall, who are those people? And is an air barrage likely to change their loyalties, Ali?
Yes, I think so. I think there are several types of people around Gaddafi. First of all, you can see that his special forces and people who are working with him in his cabinet and in his operation, and he has the revolutionary committees, and also he has some of the tribes from the south, which he promised a lot of money and positions in order to stick around him. So, but first-hand experience, okay, what we saw, what happened in Benghazi, once the freedom fighters take over a place, usually all the supporters of Gaddafi come with them, because okay, they are not really ideologically with him. They are just they're just there because he is in power. When they see that he's losing power, most probably they would peel off, like you said, yeah.
Nejla, paint a scenario for us of how this might unfold. If you're hopeful that he may still go, how might that transpire?
Well, I mean, I agree with Mr. Jaberi here. I think that there are different types of people who are supporting Gaddafi. There are people who have their sort of economic interests, political interests aligned with him. There are people who are part of his revolutionary committees who are perhaps more loyal to him. But we've seen already in the last few weeks so many defections, both from the military and also from his government, ambassadors, and so on. So I think it's a very probable scenario that as the situation escalates, that there will definitely be peeling away and defections from his supporters.
Tom, we saw some Libyan military defecting in the first flush of the uprising, but that unraveling did not seem to go on and on and on. At a certain point, it stopped. The Gaddafi's forces rallied and really turned this thing around to the point where they had their foot on the neck of the uprising by last Friday.
Yeah, Tom. I was over there on the border between Tunisia and Libya at that time, and there are a bunch of us there waiting for the Gaddafi government to fall. At that point, we were going to go charging into Libya, and it sure seemed to us like that was the case. I mean, each day you had ambassadors. I mean, you had the deputy ambassador to the United Nations leave. You had the Libyan ambassador to the United States and other major countries. It certainly seemed like it was going. And I think that what happened, I mean, I would defer to Mr. Dabri and to Nejla, for a Libyan perspective on this. But it seems that the violence and the brutality and the fierceness, the ferocity of Gaddafi's counterattack unnerved some of the opposition and sort of blunted that drive. It seemed there for a while like violence and brutality might actually work.
What are you hearing from security defense analysts? There was a time when it looked like all you'd have to do is, you know, lay down one line of fire across that highway that goes across northern Libya, the main highway, and you could stop Gaddafi's troops. But that wasn't done. They were all the way on the edge of Benghazi and into Benghazi. I mean, is it clear that this can all be sort of, ended with a barrage here? Could we end up in the kind of conflict that Gaddafi is warning? Of course, he's a propagandist. He's very skillful at that and creative. But who's to say that this won't turn into something long and messy, Tom?
That's a really good question, and I don't think you can be sure of that. I think there is one tactic here that the coalition has, which is very important, and that is that they can cut his supply line. He has overextended his forces. They are, as you said, all the way over to Benghazi and Ajabiya, and his supply line is very vulnerable. I mean, Libya is mostly a desert, and he depends on that coastal highway there to get supplies to his troops. If those supply lines are cut, his forces will be a lot more vulnerable. On the other hand, if he pulls back, if he parks his tanks in cities, in Sirte, in Misurata, in Ajabiya,
near civilians.
If he parks near civilians, it'll be virtually impossible to hit them without causing civilian damage, and then he might just think that he could wait it out. I think you mentioned at the top of the program, Tom, that the Arab League supports this move, but the Arab governments are extremely nervous about this operation, and I think there is a fear that if it does get drawn out, if it slips into a stalemate situation, you might see some ambivalence, some second thoughts among some of those key Arab government supporters.
We've already seen the Egyptian Arab League leader Amr Moussa become critical, saying this is going beyond what we expected. Now I'm reading reports that he's stepped back from some of that criticism, but yes, very tenuous kind of support there. Ali Jabri, if Gaddafi tries to hunker down for a kind of civil war or extended fight here, do you think he can do it?
I don't think he has the resources to do that. I think all the support he has now is just the people around him, the army. What I saw earlier, what happened just in 2 days of bombing, that the army collapsing. And I don't think he can fight it for that long. I think it's just, okay, if we have just a small chance for the freedom fighters, they will just take over. I tell you this because of an experience that happened to us in Tripoli. On the 20th of February, just normal demonstrators with no weapons started from several areas in Tripoli, going to the Green Square. We saw some of his police and the special forces throwing off their clothes so they can run away. I mean, we know that there's a lot of fear in them. And they know that, okay, this is a big thing happening, and they know that a change is coming. But, okay, they want to fight, they want to stick around as long as, okay, they see that Gaddafi is winning. But once the scale shifted, I think I don't think the scenario would go for a civil war, no.
Nejla, the whole world kind of presumed things would go that way when Libya was riding immediately behind Tunisia and Egypt. But, you know, in the weeks since then, I mean, we saw just how far the uprising collapsed under that fierce attack from Gaddafi. Do you still have the fundamental confidence that the mass of people will step up or that critical leadership will step away from this man and leave him alone?
Yes, I do. And I think that the people are waiting for the support, and they appreciate the support, and that they will rally in the next few days and step up and try to continue what they were doing. But if I could just address one thing.
Yes.
You brought up Amr Moussa, the Secretary General of
Arab League.
Of the Arab League. Mm-hmm. And I was very confused by his statement. I'm not sure what he thought was meant by a no-fly zone, but I think everyone knows that a no-fly zone entails taking out air defense systems, which means missile strikes. So there's really no explanation for that one. I think he has his own interests to think of running for president of Egypt. The rest of the Arab League have their own interests to think of, as does Europe and the United States. But the Libyans have an interest in the safety of the Libyan people and the future of the country. And I think that really in all the discussion about sort of this perception of U.S. invasion in the Arab Muslim world or Western invasion in the Arab Muslim world, and concern about the Arab street, concern about, you know, the interest game. Everybody has their interests, clearly. But I think that people really need to bear in mind that this is first and foremost a mission that has as its goal basically preventing what could potentially be a huge humanitarian catastrophe in Libya. And so I just wanted to make that point.
Point made. Let me bring our listeners in, if I may. Ahmed is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Ahmed, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to make a couple of points. I agree with everything that everyone said. I actually wanted to make the point where let's not give Gaddafi the impression that he's going to be in power. That's like a big mistake if you do, because then all those people that are in Libya who are supporting him somewhat are only supporting him thinking that he'll be in power, and they don't want to be creating enemy with him. But once we realize that we're in, let's not turn around and go halfway.
But surely all the bombs that fell over the weekend are a signal to Gaddafi that he's in trouble. I guess the question is, how long? How much will it take? How deeply will foreign forces be engaged here to help make this happen, Ahmed? How far should it go?
I think that the Gaddafi, we've seen over the weekend the type of ammunition and guns that he was going to kill his own people with. We destroyed that, and we saw that he's no mercy, and therefore he needs to get out of an office. Whatever it takes, it shouldn't take long with all the international community that are mentioned here. At the same time, the other point that I wanted to make is not to destroy too much of the Libyan defense, in which some of the Libyan people might consider that this is some part of their sovereignty. You know, and also we have to consider that all these soldiers are sons and fathers and whatnot of the civil itself.
It becomes a difficult line to walk, Ahmed. But I'm obviously you're right. A very important one there. Tom Jelton, do you have a gut sense or official Washington's gut confidence in this working? Does this seem like something that they've got a pretty clear beat on where they want to go, what they think it will take to tip, or not?
I think among the uniformed leadership, the military leadership, there is a profound sense of unease. I mean, there are a lot of red flags that are going off here at Tom. I mean, we talked at the beginning about coalition. Well, wars fought by committees have generally not gone well. We saw that in Kosovo. Absent an exit strategy, operations without clear exit strategies have not gone well. So there's a lot of aspects of this operation that do make people here nervous, particularly in the military.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the intervention in Libya, very big over the weekend already, and where it goes. Tom Jelton of NPR joins us from Washington. Libyan-American dissident Nejla Abdelrahman joins us from New York, and Ali Jabri joins us from Europe, an American-educated Libyan businessman who was wounded in some of the demonstrations in Tripoli, is now getting treatment back in Europe, but with us on the phone today. We're glad to have all three of them here. Here's Secretary of State Hillary Clinton again, stressing the international character and limited but crucial American role in the military operations over Libya.
Now, America has unique capabilities, and we will bring them to bear to help our European and Canadian allies and Arab partners stop further violence against civilians, including through the effective implementation of a no-fly zone.
But there's already talk about a no-fly zone perhaps not being enough. Yesterday on CNN State of the Union, John McCain criticized the Obama administration for waiting too long to carry out airstrikes, but he held out hope even so, but he called for consideration of even more measures.
I hope it's not too late, and I believe it's not too late. Obviously, if we had taken this step a couple of weeks ago, a no-fly zone would probably have been enough. Now, a no-fly zone is not enough. There needs to be other efforts made.
Tom Gelton, what's your sense of the firmness of this coalition, and what made it come together in the end? Was it the fear, as Nejla points out, of a humanitarian, slaughter? Not a humanitarian, but just simply a slaughter, humanitarian crisis in Libya? Is there something else going on here? I mean, Germany didn't join in. We had abstentions that let it happen from Russia, China, and others. What's your sense of the chemistry that flipped the trigger for this for the green light on this, Tom?
Well, I hate to point this out, Tom, but this would not have been the first occasion when the United States and its allies turned a blind eye to humanitarian crises and emergencies. And we've managed in the past to look the other way when great humanitarian needs presented themselves. I think there was actually more strategic thinking behind this decision than simple altruism in the face of this humanitarian crisis. I think there was a great fear of instability spreading in an extremely important region. I mean, we saw, as you mentioned several times, peaceful uprisings in Tunisia and in Egypt, but then the next phase of uprisings was increasingly violent in Bahrain. We've seen what started out as a democratic pro-reform uprising turn into what seems to be a sectarian uprising, with the danger of a proxy conflict between the big Sunni-Shia civil war that we've been waiting for years, with Iran on one side and Saudi Arabia on the other side. And I think there was a sense that this whole region was on the verge of really spiraling out of control. It was time to get in there and try and bring some order back into the situation. I think from a strategic point of view, that was the factor. I think that politically, once the Arab League signaled its support, whether it was ambiguous or ambivalent or whatever, once the Arab League signaled its support for this operation, I think that was the final factor that compelled these governments to act.
But let me ask you, Tom, even through that strategic prism, if they were worried about instability spreading in the region, how does intervention in Libya put a cork in that? How does it stop it? Could it not go the other way?
Well, one thing it does, I think, I hate to speak for them, but I think one of the lessons that they want to get across here is that there are certain lines that governments cannot cross without consequences. I think that, what they were looking at in Libya was the prospect at the time, a prospect of a civil war. And there is a prospect of, as I said, of a civil war in Bahrain. You haven't mentioned the situation in Yemen or in Syria.
Yeah.
I mean, we have the prospect of armed conflict in a lot of these areas. And I think the fear was that if Gaddafi was able to achieve his aims militarily, it might encourage other governments to follow that precedent, model.
But doesn't that depend on the message here being, we went in to stop Gaddafi or to punish his forces, and if you use too much force in Yemen or Syria, anywhere else, we might do the same to you? I mean, is that realistic? After all, the leader who's under pressure in Yemen is a longtime U.S. ally. Are we really going to go in and, start laying down a no-fly zone on that ally? This is not like Gaddafi.
No, that's exactly right, and that's a good point. But I think there's a fear that governments like Saleh's in Yemen will go too far in their effort to hold on to power and sort of blow it. I think that the pressure, both in Bahrain and in Yemen, by the United States on these governments has been to convince these governments that if they want to stay in power, they're going to have to find a nonviolent way to do it. I think that's the message. I agree with you. They don't want to see, or they didn't want to see, the Saleh government in Yemen overthrown, or the government, the monarchy in Bahrain overthrown. But I think that they're worried that the leaders of those governments are going to miscalculate and do something which will result in them being overthrown. I mean, I think at this point, the chances of the Saleh government in Yemen staying in power for more than 24 hours as a result of the developments that we've seen there today are actually pretty remote.
I mean, those developments, including we now have elements of his own armed forces turning against him, rival tanks deployed in the streets of Yemen's capital on Monday.
Exactly.
Nejla Abdulrahman, how do you see the chemistry of the whole region's uprisings, Arab wave, as it's been called, being affected by the big outside intervention in Libya? Does it hearten the uprisings? Does it put the fear into other leaders of using, you know, military crackdown? Or, you know, does it turn the Arab street the other way and make them fearful of Western intervention on the back of the democracy cry?
Well, I agree with Tom 100% that what happens, what's happening in Libya now has enormous implications for what happens in the rest of the Arab countries as they deal with these uprisings, and that their leaders are watching very closely. And I agree that they're watching to see if Gaddafi's use of force in Libya, if it is successful in Libya in suppressing this uprising, how this could sort of change the trajectory of or the momentum of the revolutions in Libya, that they'll be able to look at it and say, okay, well, if we use excessive force, then we might be able to crush these revolutions and maintain power. I may be cynical, but I am suspicious that there was a significant amount of arm twisting as far as the Arab League is concerned, in terms of their supporting the no-fly zone. Mm-hmm. That's just my opinion. I think that most of these countries have regimes sort of similar in many ways to the Gaddafi regime.
Right.
That they're trying to put out fires in their own countries, and the last thing they want to see is something like this succeeding in Libya. And we also know that sort of cooperation of the Arab League was one of the UN Security Council's sort of requirements for moving forward on the no-fly zone. But I agree completely that what happens in Libya is very important for what's going to happen in the rest of the region. And we're watching very closely what's happening in Yemen and Bahrain right now.
Wow. Talk about a lot of pots boiling at once. Nejla, have you heard of other interventions that we haven't heard from in the headlines? We've got this no-fly zone, but here we see rebels with shotguns and hunting rifles, we're hearing from NPR reporters today. Have you seen signs or indications of other kinds of Western support for the Libyan rebels?
You know, I haven't, actually, but I just kind of want to mention one thing. In terms of you bring up the weapons issue. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if the rebels are getting support in terms of weapons. I kind of hope that they are at least getting some equipment, but I haven't heard one thing discussed, and that is that between 2005 and 2009, ever since the arms embargo. The European Union's arms embargo against the Gaddafi regime in Libya was lifted, that the European Union and European Union countries have sold over the course of 4 years the Gaddafi regime approximately $1.3 billion worth of arms.
Which are now in the process of shredding from the sky.
Right. This included aircraft. It included electronic equipment. It included guns and ammunition. It included even chemical weapons and radioactive material. And this is all published in a Guardian report that actually was published before any of this happened in Libya. And so I think that this point sort of needs to be made. I haven't heard it made. It might not be the right time, but we sort of look at this intervention, and this is maybe one of the reasons why I'm sort of have mixed feelings about it, because I feel like the Western powers have, and especially European powers, have some responsibility in arming the Gaddafi regime and selling him the weapons and the materials that he's using against his people right now. And incidentally, the top four countries that sold weapons to the Gaddafi regime over these years were, in this order, Italy, France, the UK, and Germany.
Tom, I have a question for Mr. Jabri, if you
yes,
still.
Yes, Tom Gelton.
The United States and other governments have been reluctant to fully endorse the rebels as an alternative government, much less to arm them. I mean, Secretary Clinton was asked specifically mm-hmm. if the United States were ready to recognize the National Council, and she said they were not because they didn't know them well enough. Uncertainty about whether they're trustworthy, whether they're politically capable, what agendas they have. I'm curious what Mr. Jabri's sense of those issues are.
Well, I think Mr. Abdeljalil is a known person in Libya, and he's pro-democracy, and that's why, okay, we all rallied behind him. And for us, okay, this is not a government that will stay. It's only, they pronounce it very loudly, okay, they only stay as a transition period, mm-hmm. and then we will have a democratic country, yeah? So even we have our own saying about this leadership now, but we know that, okay, it's only for the transition period, and then we will have a normal democratic government.
But who's leading? Who's really the main support of the uprising, Ali Jabri? Is it particular tribes that have long been in opposition?
No, this time it's all over Libya, believe me. And, okay, we've been following on the Facebook. It's almost everybody I know that they're just rallying behind Mr. Abdeljalil.
You know, Nejla, it is mm-hmm. odd, though, that even high-level U.S. officials are saying, on and off the record, we don't really know who the rebels are. Does
right.
that make sense
to
you?
Just a quick note about the Interim Transitional National Council. We do know who they are. Mr. Mustafa Abdeljalil that mm-hmm. Mr. Jabri mentioned, he's the former justice minister in Libya in the Gaddafi regime, but he's someone who has enormous respect and support among pro-democracy Libyans in Libya and among Libyans in the international community. He's well known for having done a lot of good things for Libyans in the country, and the fact that someone who actually worked in the Gaddafi regime, who was supported by the pro-democracy Libyans inside the country, is really a testament to that. The council itself is composed of approximately 31 members, representatives from all over the country. Some of them have been named, mostly in the eastern region. Other people have not been named for safety reasons in the western region. And the council, of course, as we know, has been recognized by France, but the rest of the international community has been hesitant. So Libyans, we know who they are. And from everything that I've heard from people inside of Libya, in Benghazi, in other eastern cities, and Libyans outside of the country, there is enormous support for the Transitional National Council among Libyans. I really haven't heard any negativity or anybody who's expressed sort of doubts about the council.
How do you interpret the caution, then, that we've heard from American leadership, even high military leaders over the weekend saying, don't assume that Muammar Gaddafi will necessarily have to go here. Maybe he won't.
Mm-hmm.
Can you see a successful outcome here that does not include the departure of Muammar Gaddafi from power in Libya?
No, I can't. And the United States especially has been very careful to say that this intervention is a humanitarian intervention and that the goal is to safeguard Libyans, to protect them from attacks by al-Gaddafi.
But President Obama said Gaddafi must go.
Right. And so we sort of have these mixed signals, and I'm sure there are political reasons for that. But France and Britain have been perhaps more forceful in this idea of regime change and been more open to the idea of sort of taking of the idea that Gaddafi has to go, and we know that David Cameron himself said that the country doesn't have a future that includes Gaddafi. So I think at this point, perhaps the United States and some of the international community are hesitant to recognize the council because they don't know who they are. But maybe they're also just trying to figure out what to do.
Ali Jabri, how long do you think before we know whether this is paving the way for Gaddafi's ouster or turning into some kind of longer-term civil war? How long?
I think probably very soon. I think once Tripoli starts moving, things will turn around very fast. I'm hoping, putting all my wishes that, within the next weekend, Tripoli, I already hear that some demonstrations already in Tripoli against Gaddafi, and, I would say within next week, things are start moving towards that, the Gaddafi will lose the power in Tripoli. Once they lose the power in Tripoli, I would say within a couple of weeks, he's out.
Tom Gelton, the French have recognized the rebel government in Benghazi. The United States has not. How do you interpret that? What do you make of that?
I think first of all, the highest percentage of foreign fighters captured in Iraq, affiliated with Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the country that sent the most was Libya. The Al-Qaeda in Libya has been an enemy of Gaddafi. Many of them were arrested, but many of them have been released in the last few weeks. Mm-hmm. I think there's a great deal of concern about Al-Qaeda sympathizers sort of positioning themselves to take advantage of a chaotic situation in Libya.
We clearly have a lot more to learn here. Listeners, I'm sorry to get to more of your calls today, but there's just so much to figure out about what's going on. We will have more hours and more time on Libya, no doubt, with everything that's unfolding there right now. I'm really grateful to the three of you for being here today, right after this has hit the fan over the weekend. Tom Gelton with NPR, it's always great to have you with us. Thank you very much for your insights today, Tom.
Always good to be with you, Tom.
Ali Jabri, American-educated Libyan businessman recovering from wounds in the uprising in Europe. Ali Jabri, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom. Thank
and
you.
Nejla Abdurrahman in New York. Nejla, thank you for your insights and your time.
Thank you so much, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.